Oh man, we'll kick those tires and start that perpetually virtually fake fire. We are camping, sort of, but today we will be talking a little bit about quantum mechanics and multiverses potentially. So consider this another dimension where these seemingly bland backdrops are actually gateways to creative discussion and all sorts of humorous anecdotes. And with me to help tell these amazing stories is Mr. Blake Crouch, a best-selling author and screenwriter, who I often conflate his name with Blake Snyder from Save the Cat. Anyways, Blake Crouch, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
I know you have, this is interview 6,434 for you, but I assure you it will be one of the more pleasant ones. I will try to ask you not the same questions that you will be inevitably asked on everyone. So let's just dive right into it. We live in a clickbait society, so why don't we just get clickbaity here? You've had to dive into some quantum mechanics in your writing. You've had to learn a thing or two. Basically, you could consult on Interstellar now, I'm sure. But what are some cool things or just trippy things that, as a layperson, the average person should know about quantum mechanics? Like, what are some just mind-blowing things that you're like, wow, this could be true with quantum mechanics, and this will just like fry your brain?
Okay. So everyone knows, what does quantum mechanics really mean? Like, do you know what it means? Like, do you actually know what it means?
I'm basing this off that there's a quantum theory of basically these subatomic particles and a whole other realm that we can't imagine that has applications that could manifest in a whole different array of thoughts. And that's why when we talk about this, I'm thinking like, you're not saying this is necessarily true, but if this theory opens up the door that there's a world where there's projections and different dimensions. And I love, what are the applications that could happen for this?
Well, it is a theory, but elements of the theory have been proven true in a big picture way. So quantum mechanics is sort of like the physics set for the subatomic world. You know, we have the laws of physics that we're all aware of that operates in our daily lives. If you throw an apple, it's going to fall on the ground. We can generally only be in one place at a time, as far as we're aware. We don't have doubles of ourselves running around in other places. Like, these are the things that we are aware of as human beings on this planet. But subatomic particles behave very, very differently in a lot of fascinating, fascinating ways. And like what you just said, like, it's a theory, but if it is borne out, then it becomes this multiverse of possibility. So one of the things that I discovered when I was researching dark matter and that really made me want to write the book was that they have proven that quantum mechanics is applicable to what we call macroscopic objects. And a macroscopic object is something that can be seen with the naked eye. You don't have to have a microscope to see it.
You and I are macroscopic objects.
We are macroscopic objects.
Macro, baby.
A grain of sand is a macroscopic object. An electron is not. An atom is not. A molecule is not. So this guy named Aaron O'Connell in 2010, in a clean room, which is this room where you basically, in this environment where you bring everything down as close to absolute zero as possible, remove all possible interference elements coming into the situation. He took this superconducting wafer, which it was technically a macroscopic object, and he machined this little, it's almost like a diving board, and put this particle at the end of it. And he made it vibrate at different frequencies at the same time, which is essentially a macroscopic object being put into multiple realities, into a place of superposition. It's crazy. And if that, the difference between the size of this object that he made vibrate at different frequencies simultaneously and electrons and atoms, if you're talking about scale, the difference in scale from that, from an electron and or proton and this thing he made, and the difference from that thing and us is—it's very similar. So if that can happen, then it starts to raise a lot of really interesting questions about, well, are we actually in multiple places at the same time?
Yeah, that's so basically the interpretation of this thing is, if you know, scaled up from this object, is that technically that object was in more than one place at one time.
Yes,
that
it
is.
It was in something called a superposition.
Now, what is a superposition?
A superposition is a very complicated thing, which I'm going to just give in a nutshell sort of a thing, because you could talk for an hour and still be dancing around what it really means. That's like the thing with all the terminology. When you actually, the deeper down you go, you have to know 500 other things to actually understand it. In a nutshell, superposition is the idea of, like, if we were in a multi, like, let's say I stepped into a box, and this box was the gateway to the multiverse, and that when you took a drug that sort of stopped your brain from selecting a reality, and you were able to shut that off, which is, I'm describing what happens in dark matter. If you're able to do that, and this box became this infinite corridor, when you are standing in this infinite corridor, and every 12 feet there's a door that leads into a different world, that would be, you would be in a superposition. It is an undetermined state of being sort of delocalized. You're really not in one place. You are in a probability of places.
Whoa. I know this is not the most apt comparison, but is it like right now I go around with like my first person point of view, but like a superposition would allow me in some way potentially to switch to the omniscient point of view. And like if we were using a narrative fiction.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'll try that.
To write from every character's point of view at the same time.
Wow, that's so cool. See, as a multitasker, yeah. I'm drawn to a superposition. That sounds that sounds appealing.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Now I know this may not be necessarily quantum mechanics too, but I also it's sort of in a similar world. But is it true too that these those experiments where they look at particles and particles somehow know they're being observed, even if they're mm-hmm. There's no way, like there's no mechanism we know of that, how they're being preserved. Is that, I don't know if that's technically quantum, but that's something that happens too, right?
Yeah. I think what you're talking about is it's sort of the observer effect. like you can know in physics, in quantum mechanics, you can know the location of something, or you can know its speed. I think I'm getting this right, but you cannot know both things. It's the same reason the whole idea of Schrodinger's cat, which is a metaphor for the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. What happens is so Schrodinger's cat is this thought experiment. You have a cat in a sealed box. There's this poison that's like held in this radioactive vial. And if this vial is triggered, and it has a 50% chance, and it'll be triggered by this particle decaying. If this particle has a 50% chance of decaying or not decaying. And if it decays, it will break this vial, release the poison, and kill the cat. So before you open the box, because this particle has this 50-50 chance of decaying or not decaying, if you follow that causality down to the cat being alive or dead, before you open the box, the cat is in a superposition. It has a 50-50 probability of being alive or dead. But only when you open the box and look in, you essentially decohere the reality into one reality. Cat's alive, or the cat vial broke and the cat was poisoned. And it's in a weird way, it's like our observation of it makes that reality one way or the other. And that's one of the things that's wild and unexplainable about quantum mechanics. Why does it seem that that the observation of conscious beings or measurement is another sort of stand-in for it? Why does that seem to determine the state of a reality? And it doesn't make, it seems to make no sense. It's as weird as the whole spooky action at a distance thing. It's so counterintuitive to the way that we live and understand things in our world, the macroscopic world.
Now, this is, I wish I had a nootropic sponsor right now. That'd be fantastic, because it's like, now a word from, is your mind blown? Well, it doesn't have to be. I'll try that. Actually, well, there's a product called Magic Mind. I'll give William a shout out. But blow your mind with quantum mechanics. So I'm curious, you know, you write about some really deep and edgy stuff, which I love. And obviously, you know, I won't fawn the praise of the Michael Crichton comparison, even though we love him. And you in my opinion, you are the heir apparent to him.
Oh, thank you.
You know, and I just love, it's fun. I just read Jurassic Park for the first time. Someone just like, dude, have you read the book? And I was like, I love Michael Crichton. Like, have you actually read the book though? And I was like,
What'd you think?
The one I missed. You know, it's funny.
It's not what you expect, is it?
It's not at all. It's funny to see what they changed about everything. Honestly, I like the book more than the movie, and the movie's great. Like,
yeah,
we love you, Amblin. But it was like, the book was fantastic, and there's stuff also. Yeah, and I wish I had read it first. But it's scary. It's like a horror book, you know.
Yeah. It's very deep in the weeds and chaos theory and
yes. Oh and yeah, genetics. I love nature finds a way. Mm-hmm. Which I do love. I love anything that exposes human arrogance. I absolutely love. But I'm curious, you know, as you wade into these waters of quantum mechanics and just all these strange phenomena and you fictionalize them for us and you know, open our minds to these realities, has it given you any thought, any pause, or just how do you reflect potentially on like topics of faith and spirituality as you get into, is quantum mechanics sort of serve as a, do you think that is an explanatory mechanism for some of the, and I ask this as someone who, you know, recreationally and now professionally has some, you know, stake in researching, we'll call it metaphysical phenomena, but in your, you know, dive into quantum mechanics stuff, how do you think about the world and kind of just, yeah, the non-physical part of you?
Yeah, I definitely don't think it explains a big sky deity in the context of what's literally just disintegrating the minds of our country right now. I don't think it explains, or comes close to explaining that. What I do think is that what I love about quantum mechanics is that it suggests that things are much weirder and more mysterious than we realize, and that there are definitely unknowable things out there that we'll probably never understand, things that run counter to our understanding and interpretation of the world, and that we should try to keep an open mind and be open to the idea that, like, we're still trying to figure out why we're here, how the universe started, or the multiverse. All these fundamental questions of existence, we're still trying to wrap our heads around those answers. I mean, we really truly don't know exactly what happens when we die. It's probably a big black nothing, but it's sort of an untestable notion.
Yeah.
It excites me, and I like that there are mysteries still out there. I don't think it actually opens the door to faith, because I think faith is the antithesis, not faith, but I think religion is sort of the antithesis to loving the mysterious. The reason religion exists, it exists for people who do not deal with uncertainty, who can't deal with no answers, who can't deal with the universe being a big mysterious void and not knowing where it came from. I don't think it actually is, I don't remember how you put it eloquently, but I like how you put it, a mechanism for, I think, explaining or channeling.
Explanatory mechanism for some of the, and what I was getting at too is, like, you know, because I've researched in my own, like, just personal stuff, and I've seen, like, a friend of mine, Dr. Candy Brown, has done some really interesting peer-reviewed research with Harvard Medical School on blind and deaf people, and admittedly small sample sizes, but in a peer-reviewed journal, Southern Medical Journal, where people who were touched in what's called proximal intercessory prayer, where someone was, like, prayed for, and these people received eyesight and hearing back, and they weren't people missing eyes and like regenerative miracles, but it was interesting because the foreword done by the journal said, you know, no one is claiming that a, you know, sky deity healed them, but we are saying that there is some mechanism that goes beyond hypnosis and placebo, because you can't think your way into seeing better, because there's objective tests that measure it. So I always just, I love to kind of dwell in the mystery of, like, I know a lot of people have experienced even those weird timing things too. You know, people call them sometimes like God winks, or those kind of Twilight Zone moments where, you know, those little hints that, like, makes me wonder, like, are we all living in Elon Musk simulation? You know, is there, you know, is it right? Or is the Hail Mary project true? Is Andy Weir trick us? You know, is there something else out there? It makes me wonder. So I wondered if in the realm of quantum mechanics, that could potentially explain, you know, sometimes too, what people experience, and think they do. And so that was more.
I wrote a book called After Dark Matter. It was called Recursion. that was sort of about memory travel, but also it had a weird, it was sort of the other side of the coin to dark matter in terms of the presentation of reality and things. And it touched and it presented this really interesting, weird idea of how time travel might work. The idea of it was very complicated. I'm not going to try to explain the whole thing here, but essentially, if you go back, let's say we're at point B right now, let's say you go back to point A and you start living a new point A to point B, that original point A to point B is now like a dead timeline. Okay, didn't happen. But when you catch back up chronologically to your original point B, everyone then suddenly flashed in with these memories of this dead timeline. I sort of called it the reverse Marty McFly. Yeah. And that was my way into the book. I was like, what if at the end of Back to the Future, if when Michael J. Fox returns, instead of his parents just being great and his dad being a successful novelist and Biff being a car maintenance dude, what if all that was still real and happening? This is not my phone. This is my wife's phone.
So, sponsor, is that Sprint? Is that the Sprint sound check? Could be your sponsor?
No, it's
or Nextel.
No, it's a. I'm gonna turn it off. It's an Android. I don't even know how our phone works. But anyway,
we can see if someone's an Apple user. Did you see the disdain by which the droid was heaved across? A true creative and a showrunner is Apple.
I can't even understand how to turn this phone off. Anyway, so, but what if all this stuff still happened, but they remembered the original? They remembered when it was different. They remembered when the tables were turned and Biff was still like bullying Michael J. Fox's dad in the real world, you know, in his life as an adult, and that his mom was a drunk and all these things. And I loved that. And it was one of the things that made me think that a phenomena like deja vu could maybe be a suggestion of remembering these old timelines that, you know, maybe for all we know, we are constantly bouncing around from one timeline to the other. And we think we have continuity and remember the full course of our lives. What if that's just an illusion? And what if the deja vu phenomenon is actually like that glitch in our mind where we're getting these flash, that sense of, God, I've been here before. I've talked to this person before. We've actually had this conversation. I remember saying these exact words. What if that touches on something? That's the kind of stuff that I'm definitely open to when it comes to exploring what quantum mechanics and memory and all these things
I love that.
Make possible.
I love that. I love that for deja vu too. I never liked how deja vu got co-opted into sort of an adult nightclub reference and seems to be the name of a lot of inappropriate venues in Vegas, you know, but no, it's fun. And I've had, as a kid, I actually had that experience where I would oftentimes get to a vacation spot, and this is a little bizarre, but I would draw pictures and know the room that we were going to. And there were some very vivid dreams where I was like, I have been like, it just, and I remember I'd write that down on my little dream journal I had, which is, you know, I probably sound like a kid from The Shining, but it was really like, that phenomena is so powerful sometimes. And it just does, those to me are little clues of just like, all right, I'm not just a skeleton, flesh and bone. There's more than just the macroscopic side you see of me, right? Mm-hmm. It's a good Hallmark card too. I'm more than macroscopic. Okay. Like, I see you, but do you see me at a I see you at a quantum level.
Yes. All right,
we'll do that. We should do a joint venture on that. I would love to, thank you for humoring me into this. And I want to get to obviously the writing and stuff, but I love the topics and just the unique take on all this stuff. And also just funny because time travel is so, and overdone in some ways, and I always appreciate a new take on it. I do want to just do a quick, you know, sort of lightning round here, because, you know, like any good since we are doing multiverse and talking about, you know, like Marvel, you know, there's I would love to do the Blake origin story here too. If we can just get a survey of point A to point B as we currently see it. So from North Carolina. All right. And then any glimpses at a young age that you're like, man, this guy's going to go on to be this wildly successful writer on all these cool topics. Do we see any, warning signs of the glory to come?
Just the story. I would tell my brother stories when he's 6 years younger. So I would tell him bedtime stories, like scary horror thriller okay. bedtime stories. And I also wrote when I was 13, I wrote a sequel to Return of the Jedi.
You know what? It's probably better than what came. Sorry.
it's
better than Star Wars.
It is. It is in every single metric.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm not generally like an asshole. It's not saying anything great about this. It's saying the other thing about the other thing. It's just
I am a true Star Wars fan, and all my true Star Wars fans, I don't know a single one of them who are fans of what has transpired. Yeah. And that's just a subjective opinion. It's like quantum theory. It's a theory, you know, but it just is. I just don't think it's great.
This is how much I don't care. I don't care to say it out loud. There's no part. Like once upon a time, I was like, God, I would love to be involved or work with that in any capacity. Literally have zero interest in that. So I don't care. Like, just honestly, it's just like, what a tragedy, what happened there. What an absolute tragedy. Just taking a beautiful story in a world and a brand and just monetizing it and nostalgifying it into oblivion. It's just something of a
preach, brother, preach. I know.
Yeah.
I know. But all right. So
the only moment that captured it for me ever again was that I can't remember if it's first or second season of The Mandalorian. There were some moments there where I was like, whoever is in charge of this episode, they should just let this person do everything going forward. And whoever is doing this, because it was the only thing I'd seen literally since the original trilogy that made me feel the way the original trilogy made me feel. Man. But here's the thing. They're not trying to make us feel that way. They're just trying to make money.
And I know how parched we were, because it's like at the time when I saw Rogue One, I was like, this is really good. And I'm asking myself, like, how good is this good? Would I think this was good if I had a lot of other options? And the only moment I have felt super excited in Star Wars recently is there's a couple Mandalorian moments. Mm-hmm. That final scene in Rogue One where Vader boards the ship and just starts owning people. I was like, mm-hmm. that's kind of cool. That's how I felt when they gave Yoda. The last time I felt that was in the theater when they gave Yoda a lightsaber in Attack of the Clones, which is also not great. So it's obviously harder to write a Star Wars movie than I thought. But man, when he grabbed that lightsaber and I'm like, is Yoda about to go throw down? I'm like, the audience stood up and applauded. And that was like, I haven't had that experience.
I think there's an argument to be made that episode 3 was actually telling a new story. There was a new feeling. It wasn't all great, but there was a newness about it and an edginess that felt like an actual continuation of something instead of just, trying to beat the money out of a dying thing. I don't know. I have a lot of feelings about Star Wars because I loved it so much. And
I did too, man. And so, and now we should go to a word of our sponsor, Disney. I'm just kidding. But so you wrote,
sorry,
so you,
Disney.
Hi Disney. So you wrote, a superior, sequel to Return of the Jedi, told stories to your brother. And then you're just a storyteller at a young age and very creative. And then it sounds like you studied a little bit of creative writing, but also anthropology, kind of broad survey of, and geology even I saw too. So waiting for that, geological thriller that will rock us.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. I know. That's bad.
That's really bad.
Thank you.
He will rock you. Yeah.
That's right. It's so dumb.
I didn't take it out of any love of rocks. I just didn't want a hard science class. And I heard that's where the athletes, that's the
what's
class.
What's harder than geology? I'm sorry.
Stop.
I know. For the betterment of him, mankind, there's another quantum universe where I don't make those jokes. But but even in college, it wasn't set. It's like, hey, I'm going to be a writer. It comes afterwards.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to be, but I didn't think it was an actual career. And I was right. It was not a real career thing to shoot for. So I thought it would be an English professor for a minute, and then maybe a lawyer. But I really wanted to write. So I didn't pursue anything that was so engrossing that it kept me from writing.
Okay. And then, so what was the job? So we had Joe Lansdale on, he was talking about stacking aluminum chairs And that was his job. Jim Rollins, of course, was a vet and, you know, castrating animals while writing his novels. So do we have anything from you that you were doing before? Was the job the last job prior to really getting into writing?
I was a paralegal for this law firm in Colorado. And some of it was really interesting because it was working with like criminal defense attorney and
cool.
jail and interview like people who've done bad shit. And that was a lot of fun and actually ended up inspiring some characters and
cool.
That was the last honest day's work I did.
Okay, good. And then one thing I found interesting in an interview you gave is that your first couple novels, like you got an agent and you had a book deal, but you weren't selling as much. And you actually thought there was at one point you thought your career was done or trending downwards. So for those of us who, if there's any listeners who are potentially thinking that the end is near, there actually may be some hope and your timeline might shift. What happened with you?
Well, the self-publishing revolution came just when I needed it. And I had some backlist titles and I had a new book that I couldn't sell to a traditional publisher. So I put it out on the KDP platform and Nook and Kobo and ended up just started making like hand over fist money on these books. Now, I don't know if this is really possible today. I mean, so really actively self-published since 10 years. But then it was like you just go out and put buckets in various places outside and money just rains down into them. It was like an amazing time to be a writer.
Full so it's like the control. Federal Reserve was in charge of your career. So.
Exactly. But that didn't last. I knew it wasn't going to last. I knew even then this is a bubble. Nothing good lasts forever. I knew this was going to last even less time.
Yeah. All right. So then things took off. And then what was the book that like, this is sort of the level up. This is like, okay, now I'm like, mm-hmm. I am a writer and this is like, and also I'm going to be like, this is my thing for life now.
Probably a couple, I think there've been maybe two level ups so far. One was the first was Pines, the first, book in the Weird Pines trilogy. Cause I had ended up selling before the book was published, the, television rights to Fox. And in like Shyamalan was attached and I didn't know at the time for sure that it was going to be made, but everyone was really serious about it in a way I hadn't dealt with. Because most people prior to this moment that I dealt with who were in Hollywood, they're not serious people. And sadly, a lot of Hollywood is not made of serious people. I don't know what most of the people in Hollywood do. But these were serious people who were like going to make this and they did make it in a very big way. So that was the first big level up. And then I had two more books in that trilogy. And I think the second level up would probably be the publication of Dark Matter.
That's awesome. So actually, since you mentioned Hollywood too, it's crazy too. It's so interesting to see how quickly books come out, the options are sold, et cetera. You had awesome, Amblin got the option for Upgrade, which is so cool. And we're going to see that made by some master, storytellers that we all kind of grew up and loving. I'm curious, it's also cool. You actually get to be the showrunner too. You've been a showrunner and a lot of times they just take novelists and say, hey, like we'll put your name on there and you know, you're not really set to write this, but can you talk to us a little bit about the experience of both writing, you know, for novel and for TV and how you were able to do that? Cause my understanding is a lot of people don't get that option.
Yeah. When I sold the rights to Weird Pines, as one of the conditions of the deal, because I was very interested in the screenwriting format up to this point. I've always been fascinated by it. Even back to my first novel, I was trying to really understand and learn screenwriting form as well. I said, as a condition of this deal, you have to let me write one episode. And they're like, sure. Okay. It's really not that big of an ask, to be honest with you, because like if you mess it up, like TV is all about rewriting people. So
yeah.
And he turned out to be one of my best friends, but at the time the showrunner of Weird Pines, Chet Hodge, was like, I thought, well, you'll probably write a a terrible draft and I'll just fix it. I'll rewrite it. It's fine. It's part of the job. So yeah, sure. Go take a crack at it. And I did a pretty good job on it. And he actually gave me notes, and then we ended up writing more episodes on the show. And then I went up to the set and saw the production unfolding. And I mean, I wasn't the showrunner or anything at that point in time, but I was like starting to learn and just see kind of how the sausage got made. And so then Chad and I started working on this other project because we wanted to do something else together called Good Behavior, about this character, Letty Dobesh, who's based on, you know, my experiences working for that criminal defense lawyer and going to jail and visiting these people. And we created that show together. And it was far more like, which means, you know, for your listeners, and I'm sure you know this, means writing the pilot script. So we wrote the pilot script together and a bunch of episodes, and really was much more hands-on with that. And then, you know, I kind of, at that point in time, I didn't have anything else really big in terms of TV on my horizon. I was just kind of focused on books. And, you know, I'd sold the rights to Dark Matter to Sony when it was just a partial manuscript as a film, but no one could figure out how to make this as a film. It seemed good and possible when it was the partial stage, but the full book, it was just like, it's terrible. You're missing all these amazing moments. So I thought that was gone and there was just nothing on the horizon. But a couple of years ago, we were able to get Sony basically told us we could take it from the feature side over to the television side and explore Dark Matter as a TV show. And this was now in the age of Apple and Netflix and Hulu. It was just a very different time even than when we had sold Weird Pines. So there's no way I was going to let someone else come in here and A, either mess it up or B, worse, do a great job and just like ride off into the sunset. I was like, this whole thing has already worked out. Why would I let someone do that? So I said, hey, you know, I want to actually show run this and write this and really make it the way I see it in my head.
That's awesome. What do you find as far as someone who's done both formats now? Do you have any just high level thoughts on, you know, optimizing as far as like writing screenplays, writing novel, obviously two completely different, you know, treks and paths, but any just thoughts on the two mediums?
It's hard. I don't know that I'm a one to give a lot of advice about screenwriting because I don't write original screenplays. Everything I write is an adaptation of my own work. If I had a great idea, I would write a novel or a short story or a novella. I wouldn't go to the script form first. Because I think I really figure out the structure and the characters in prose form. So I don't know. I think it'd be very hard to write a good original screenplay. That must be a very hard thing to do. I've not tried to do it. But, you know, they are, I mean, it's obvious, but one is a very visual medium, but so is prose. I can't tell you how often when I'm like adapting something, I'm just moving chunks of paragraph as written from the book over to the final draft. The only thing that's different is like there are some time constraints and some things don't have to be described as much. There's no internal dialogue going on. You might like shore up and you might streamline some things. But for me, at least, I mean, the writing of a cinematic scene in a book isn't that different than the writing of a cinematic scene in a script. The dialogue is different. The dialogue in books has the luxury of being far more meandering. In a screenplay, you know, each scene really has to operate as a unique unit and, you know, have a reason for being there or it needs to go. So the dialogue becomes pretty easy when I'm transferring it from prose to screen. It just becomes apparent, like, oh, this is how we cut this down and get to the heart of what this is.
Well, speaking of cutting down, I think that's a great segue into my new favorite saying, and I have to read it because I'm going to butcher it, but clustered, regularly, interspaced, short, palindromic repeats. So I think that was a good transition to CRISPR.
Well done. Well done.
That's right. I had to get that. I thought CRISPRs sounded like a new app for like identifying the top fried chicken in town, but it's not. It's for those who need to know, it's gene splicing technology because that is, of course, front and center in Upgrade. I find this so fascinating, and it is also chilling what could be done. I'm curious, you know, I read a piece in, I think it was either the Atlantic or National Review or something. And it was talking about it was a thought exercise of if we suddenly have gene splicing become sort of the norm, but in some countries it's considered biologically unethical to do, but in mm-hmm. others it's okay. Will you have over time disparate, like, is it a security risk? Will you, if you have like an engineered population that's immune to health problems, super much smarter, et cetera. And it was very, very scary. So the idea that you can tinker with human genome and gene splice is just like, is absolutely terrifying to me. So I'm curious, how did you get into like this? Was this just a topic you were fascinated with?
Yeah, I was actually doing an interview on Science Friday for Dark Matter, and Ira Flatow was like, what's your next book about? And I didn't really know what it was. And I was kind of mumbling on about something. He's like, I know what it should be. It should be CRISPR. And I hadn't heard, I'd heard of it, but I didn't really know what it was. And I definitely wasn't going to try to take a stab at explaining it on Science Friday. and he said, you know, it's gene modifying technology. It's, let's just edit our own DNA. It's crazy. And I had in the back of my mind already, like, I should do something in gene editing. It seems obviously to be the next big issue I should tackle. It just seems to give a lot of cool, dramatic stuff. And so I started looking at it. And I was like, God, this is way too much science. I definitely don't want to do this. And so I went and wrote Recursion and a short and a novella called Summer Frost. And after those two projects, I wrote a script. I did so many things not to have to write this book. But then finally, it was just like, well, it's just time. What are you doing? I mean, are you a sci-fi writer? If you are, you should probably take a stab at this thing. And yeah, it was, it lived every bit up to being as hard as I feared it would be.
Well, how long did it take you to write Upgrade?
All in about 3 years.
It's funny when you say a screenplay is tough to write, having now, you know, dabbled in both mediums, I go, it is a screenplay is tough. But then you hear stories that like, oh, Sylvester Stallone wrote Rocky in 2 weeks or a night, and then Jon Favreau wrote Swingers in 2 weeks as like an experiment. But then like a novel is like, I mean, to stay. And then I think I read, I forgot if it was Recursion or Upgrade, but you had so many timelines you had to go down, or you go down a hallway of a plot, and then you have to stop and backtrack and toss out pages. I mean, it sounds brutal.
It's brutal. Recursion was hard because of the plotting and of the all the timelines, and I did end up having to write this big thing on a whiteboard in my office, like a crazy person's drawings,
like Memento. Exactly.
But this was much harder just because there was so much biology to learn, and it was just on every page, like you just kind of couldn't escape it. And the level of understanding that I didn't have about just how genes program expression and beings and creatures and us, there was such a big hurdle to get over just figuring out what questions to ask the experts. So it just took a long time. And then I started and ended up going in the wrong way. I thought I was going to write like my own Jurassic Park, and about 70,000 words in, I realized I wasn't even at the midpoint. I didn't know where the midpoint was, and I didn't know what happened next. And I'd just gone into it the complete wrong way. And then I realized that, well, you should be writing about how this impacts us, human beings. That's if you're not writing about that, then who cares? We've all seen Jurassic Park. We've all seen like weird creatures, built in a lab. How does it affect humanity? How does it affect how we think as a species? And why we are where we are? Well, is there a way this could potentially help us get out of this death spiral that we're in at the moment? And that then the book sort of took off for me.
When you have those moments, I'm curious, how brutal, because is there a moment where you're like, crap, like this is not going to work. Is that something as a writer where you're like, okay, I know I will have various false starts. That's just built mm-hmm. into there. But you know, it was this one where you're like, this is a huge bummer. Like
yeah.
I've worked.
Yeah, it was. I mean, 70,000 words is not a false start. That's that is almost a year of work. And it wasn't all lost. I mean,
right.
I learned a lot in the writing, and I took a couple of characters and a couple of backstories that I did like, and was able to salvage them. I mean, but it was generally a full, you know, board weight.
Oh, it's, I can only imagine just what that would feel like. That's a tough day.
You know, it's not, honestly, it doesn't feel as bad as you think. Like, it sucks really, because you know that, you're nowhere near as close to making your deadline as you thought you were, and that you're not going to make your deadline. But there's also a lot of peace that comes with just being honest with yourself and being like, this is not working. Let's just call this what it is. This is a pile of shit. And maybe it's time to just like admit that and actually start writing the thing that won't be shitty. So there is actually a big relief that comes with it. But you have to be very careful, because sometimes I've definitely had moments in books where I felt that same way and have been tempted to throw them away. And it was just because it was hard and I hadn't broken through yet to this. I was stopped on a scene or a character. And it's very tricky because you don't want to do that too easily either, because sometimes, is it really just bad, or have you hit a wall on this one scene that you, or this one thing that you're thinking about it incorrectly? I almost threw recursion away a few times also.
Wow.
But this was definitely the right choice for the first iteration of Upgrade.
Well, I'm glad you didn't throw it away. And I wish others had heeded the advice of maybe this is shit and we should start over. I won't name names, but others could, you know, perhaps follow that advice. Real quick, what is, since I asked about quantum mechanics, in your copious research on gene splicing, was there like, what is something crazy you learned that you're like, oh my gosh, and like maybe even something too that's like, this sounds science fiction, but this is real, like this is happening.
The craziest thing and the scariest thing I came across, which is real, it's called a gene drive. And what it does is you would essentially do some genetic modifications at the embryonic stage, like the zygote, where it's still, you know, things are still forming. And you're not just making changes to that particular embryo. Within those changes you're making, you're encoding instructions for those changes to propagate across all future progeny of this embryo. So you could literally edit out you know, certain characteristics in an entire species. You could wipe out an entire species with a gene drive. You could wipe out an entire species of insect. It's something that they're playing around with, you know, they have these mosquitoes that transmit malaria. And one of the things they're doing with a gene drive is editing out, reproductive capabilities in, I can't remember if it's the male or female that spreads malaria. But I think it might be the female mosquito. Yep. In the female mosquito. And what the upshot of that is, pretty soon you're not going to have any more of that species. And this is a real thing that exists. Now, it's not the easiest thing in the world to do. The difference from my book and where we are right now is that, like, CRISPR is, while it's wildly advanced from like ZFNs and all the prior gene modification techniques, it is still imprecise, and we don't know how all the gene suites that comprise like the 30,000 genes we have in our body, we don't know exactly how they all interact. We know some of them do, but it's not just one-to-one. Like, you know, what determines the shape of your nose or your lips or your eye color can be hundreds of genes working together. And you can't just say, oh, I'm going to turn on or turn down or upregulate this particular one. I mean, you kind of have to have a really broad understanding of how they all work together in a given organism. But as our computing power ramps up, and you know, we could start to maybe reverse engineer the expression of genes back to the actual genes themselves, then you're starting to get an understanding of the very fine details of what programs something to be alive.
Somewhere Dr. Malcolm is rolling over in his his grave. When you study humans at this level and you get down to gene stuff, does it make you, I'm trying to find the words, does it, because there's so, the part of me that is so attracted to the idea that, like, yes, I know I'm a biological creature, but part of my worldview is that I'm not just flesh, ligament, tendon, but like there is a subset of me that is metaphysical and that also carries, that confers my human worth. Like, if you clone me, it would still be different because there's something that's like my unique, my thing, right? And when you start getting into like genes and you can edit and swap out and create, like, does that kind of like harden the view of humanity? Like, does that kind of productize humanity to you? I'm trying to find the way to describe it, because it seems, if you can get down to that level, I've always dwelled in the mystery of, you know, wonderfully, fearfully made. We're all like this unique DNA sequence. But when you can start isolating and just like recreate, it's like, feels very product. I feel, you know, like a Disney film. Sorry.
You can be exactly replicated, but what no one can replicate are the experiences that you've had. You are your genes plus your experience. You're not just your genes. You're also your experience, and your experience and living in the environment and being raised by who parents and all the people in your lives who you interacted with, and all the substances or toxins or good things that you encounter, those all affect your genes, and they can change and mutate your genes. I do think the uniqueness, you know, no one's just a Disney character, because everyone has a unique experience in the world. If you look at twins separated at birth and compare them, yes, they have a lot of similarities in terms of predilections, impulses, things like that. There's still differences as well, because they're experienced. I don't know. It is a weird thing to contemplate, the idea of just genes that are all that we're made of.
It is so bizarre. All right. Well, last question for you, Blake. What's a tradition on here is, it's two lightning rounds, but if you don't have an answer to one of them, that's okay. The first one is, what would you go back and tell younger Blake? If we could do the go reverse point A, point B, is there anything that you would tell your younger self that stands out?
Yeah, I would just say, be more confident, and don't worry what people think. Don't be as fearful. Don't be ever afraid to go into any room or to try to do what you think you're capable of doing. Not in a crazy, I'm going to like, you know, I just did a pound of cocaine and I'm going to take over this cruise ship way. I just mean, like, you know, you should trust your abilities. I wish I trusted my abilities earlier than I did ultimately.
Is that a log line for a film? I'm like, it sounds too good. Like, someone does a line of cocaine, it takes up. It's like Speed 7. You know?
Speed.
Yeah, Speed. I'm like, I just love you just made that up. Like, do cocaine and take over a cruise ship. Like, he just storms the cabin. I mean, like,
Hey, Ryan, it's yours.
Okay. Hey. All right, good. Hollywood, look at that. I optioned that. Blake Crouch's new thriller, you know, so, white powder.
<You're> saying...
Oh, man. And then, since we don't have our campfire, but we always end with, is there a sort of Twilight Zone-y moment in your life, or something a little mysterious that's ever happened to you that you're like, whoa, actually, my last guest, David Holthouse, as a journalist, he was there for the Phoenix Lights. And he goes, dude, I'm telling you, I saw something in the sky that the government said was a balloon. I'm telling you, this thing was the size of a football field and not a balloon.
There's definitely, I live in the Southwest. There's definitely stuff going on in those skies down there. Like, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the military. I don't know if it's military hiding. Something's up. Something is up. The question is a mysterious.
Have you ever a Twilight Zone, a mysterious moment, ever had a ghost encounter or a spooky story?
I wrote this book Abandoned. It was my third novel that I wrote, and I knew I wanted some of the characters to go into this remote mining town. It's the ruin that are just ruins now, and way up in the mountains in Colorado. And I wanted a couple of paranormal photographers to be in this group. So I went with this paranormal photographer named Mike, who lived in my hometown. And he took me into the basement of this hotel called the Jarvis Suites, right on Main Street in Durango. And we just hung out in this weird dark basement, sort of like the Blair Witch, into the Blair Witch Project. And he was like, so do you feel that? I was like, what? He's like, that heaviness. And I was like, no. He's like, good, because they're not here right now. And then we went to another place and did the same thing. And I did feel like this. I don't know if it was psychosomatic or what, but I definitely felt like just this almost weird, vague kind of weight in the room. Yeah, I mean, that I always think back to that, you know, because I don't know, who knows what happens to our energy after. I mean, I don't think that we're some separate, there's some separate thing in us that imbues us with like consciousness, or I mean, I think consciousness is the result of all the unbelievably complex systems interacting together inside of us, and that consciousness sort of is an emergent quality of that. So I don't think it's like a separate thing, but I mean, I don't know. How would I know?
That's, well, it's funny you say that. I have, and again, obviously working on this project I shared with you earlier, that is a common manifestation that people feel when they enter into areas of alleged supernatural, is a heaviness, it's a palatable sensation. And so I believe it. So, you know, I love to these, like, yeah, I was like, do you feel it? No. Good. Cause it's not here right now. Right. Yeah. And then we went and did a line of cocaine and took over a cruise ship. And so that was, and that was it, you know? Yeah. So, do you have a copy of the book to show us as we sign off?
I do.
It's time to upgrade, America. Take up. Oh, panel. It's blurred. You got to go back. Almost. Your filter's blurring it out.
Here, look, I'm going to unblur this, and now you're going to wonder why was this ever blurred?
Upgrade. There we go. Chilling. I think you tweeted it's a love/hate letter to the species. So it's definitely want to go pick it up, and it just came out. So folks, please go get it. And also, Amblin's going to be making it into a major feature film, right?
That's the plan.
That's going to be awesome. Oh, I can't wait for that. Well, Blake, thank you so much for virtually camping with us in these bland environments. The conversation was incredible. And I just so appreciate your work. Thanks for toughing it out and for not giving up on all those. Love your work. And I do hope you'll continue to come back to us with each subsequent best-selling book that you write. And may they be many.
I would love that.
May they be many.
From your lips.
Awesome. Well, folks, we've been camping with Blake Crouch. Go upgrade your life by purchasing his book. And no, it's not a thriller about someone who get moves from coach to business. It's actually quite scarier than that. So enjoy, folks. Thanks for camping. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks for joining us, folks. If you want to help us out, and we're confident you do, go ahead and hit that subscribe button here on our YouTube channel. And if you ever feel like just listening to these, you can check us out on all major podcast streaming.